to get here. Mr. Bassett is one of them. Christine Silkstone is another. And so on and so forth. So, anyway, welcome to all of you. Purpose of this morning's meeting is to receive a briefing on the newest amendments to the trafficking bill. Stein, I'm going to ask you to take us through that. Honourable members, I've asked Monani to distribute a document from MWeb and another one from the internet service providers that also deals with the trafficking bill. They are formally requesting an opportunity to address the committee on two clauses, I believe. but we'll get to that point once you've all received a copy of it. As you know, the trafficking bill has been with us since 2009. And normally once we've had our formal hearings, it's unusual for us to grant anyone an opportunity this late. But I'm informed by some members that in the event that there are new clauses that directly affect certain people, then possibly we can make an exception in such cases. I'm not sure whether this is the case. So, Mrs. Stein, we're in your hands. Oh, sorry. The DG for Home Affairs did call me. He had left messages and reached me this morning. He's very apologetic he won't be here. And I pointed out to him that communications during our trip to Germany were obviously difficult and things got lost in the mix. And I said, no, it wasn't too much of a problem. He has to be in Pretoria this morning, and so that is why he's not here. So in the event that you want to know why he's not with us, that is the case.
Chair, I don't know whether you would like to go through the clauses that involve the Department of Home Affairs, or should I just start from the beginning of the bill?
Honourable members? Beginning. Start from the beginning.
Thank you, Chairperson. Does that mean even amendments that have been dealt with and accepted by the committee before, we have to be taken through them? I would have thought that at this stage, she would take us through those parts that were not quite resolved.
No, as I understand it, it's not only Home Affairs that are affected. There are other amendments as well, which she's going to take us through.
Yes, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
That even only those parts that were not
that's right.
Didn't have a final position on.
Am I correct, Mr. Stein? Are we okay? Right.
Thank you, Chief. On page 4, there's a footnote that you will see. We have, as indicated by the Portfolio Committee, we have removed chapter 4.
Stein, I'm sorry, but we can't hear you. At least I can't, so if you could just...
Is that better?
Much better, thank you.
On page 4, it is only indicated that we have moved chapter 5. It is now to be found at chapter 3, as was indicated or requested by the committee. Going to page 6, there is a footnote 3, the deletion of the number one, because we are not touching Schedule 2 any longer. It will only be one schedule. With regard to the definition of abuse or vulnerability, we have indicated there that it must be for purposes of Section 4. We have omitted it by referring specifically to subclause 4.1. The footnote there, if I can just go through that, abuse of vulnerability is one of the means found in the offence of trafficking in clause 4.1. And it does not seem to apply to clause 4.2, and therefore it is suggested that the definition specifically refers to section 4.1. Coming to footnote 5, the definition of body part, the committee asked us to prepare a definition of body part, and that the definitions in the National Health Act be used as a basis. There are basically three options. I don't know if I could just go through them quickly, or do you want to just first have to read through them?
Honourable members. There are three options there. One on page 6 and the other two on page 7. I want you to think about it, honourable members.
Well, maybe Ms. Stain could just take us through the differences and the suggestions.
Okay.
The first definition refers only to any, if I pronounce it correctly, a gamete, organ or tissue as defined in the National Health Act, and therefore and then we include blood because that is excluded from the definition in the National Health Act. But that means that you will every time have to go and see what is the definition in the National Health Act. On page 7, the first option there, we have included what human tissue is in the National Health Act. It includes flesh, bone, glands, skin, bone marrow, body fluid, and organ. And then we have also added to that blood and a gamete. The second option on page 7, we have looked at all the parts of the human body that is defined in the National Health Act, and we have all included it there. So I don't know whether the committee would like us rather to repeat all the definitions there, or if it is okay, if you can just refer to the definitions as in the National Health Act.
Mr. Jeffrey.
Yeah, what does the, in the Health Act, National Health Act, what is the definition of human tissue?
I could read to you, it is a definition of tissue, and it means human tissue, and includes flesh, bone, a gland, an organ, skin, bone marrow, or body fluid, but excludes blood or a gamete.
Can't hear you, Steve.
Option then includes that definition and adds blood and gametes. So that would probably be the most preferable then. You've got three options, is that right? So your middle one on the top of page 7 would include the definition of the National Health Act plus blood and gamete. And I think that's probably the way to go.
Is a gamete defined in the National Health Act? And organ, is that included as tissue?
So organ is included as tissue, but it is also separately defined in the National Health Act.
Then to me it would be more option one, or no, the definition in the bill. Because you see the problem with option one, is that human tissue is defined as flesh, bone, a gland, skin, marrow, etc., body fluid. So you don't need to repeat that. So I would then prefer gamete, organ, and tissue are defined in the National Health Act. What's not defined is blood. And so the first, I don't know why you put the first one and then there's option one, option two. I would have seen it as option one, two, and three. But anyway, the first one then seems to me to make sense, because it is gamete, organ, tissue as defined in the National Health Act, and then blood, which is excluded. Out of interest though, what is an oocyte and a zygote?
I learned about zygotes in school, but I can't remember what.
So they are all defined in the National Health Act.
proposing that we adopt under option two, including the word oocyte in our bill. What does it mean? What do you want us to include?
An oocyte means a developing human egg cell. Let me just take a look. It defines blood product, matured blood, which means any product derived or produced from blood, including circulating progenitor cells, bone marrow progenitor cells, and umbilical cord progenitor cells. An embryo means a human offspring in the first 8 weeks from conception. A gamete means either of the two generative cells essential for human reproduction. A gonad means a human testis or human ovary. As I've said, oocyte means a developing human egg cell. And then an organ means any part of the human body adapted by its structure to perform any particular vital function, including the eye and its accessories, but does not include skin and appendages, flesh, bone marrow, body fluid, blood, or a gamete. And then the definition of tissue I've read to you. And then a zygote means the product of the union of a male and a female gamete. I don't know whether it is possible to remove this body parts for the purposes of trafficking, and that is actually why we have indicated or we are proposing the one option. Option 2 on page 7.
I mean, look, option 2 is seems to be everything. If we go with option one, it is the do seem to be things left out. If we go with the first definition on page 6, there are things that are left out. Option two is effectively everything. So it makes, I mean, although it's going to cause well, I mean, most people are not going to know what these things are, as we don't. But if we want to cover everything, it's probably safer.
Chair, I would suggest that we go with the option that covers everything.
That's the one listed as option 2 on page 7. Okay. Honourable members, Mr. Swart, Mr. Sibanyoni.
Maybe just comment from the NPA in terms of, we just don't want a situation where somebody gets trafficked for oocytes or zygotes and then you can't charge them for trafficking because that hasn't been included under the definition of body part. So it's very much there for the prosecution side.
Honourable Chair, it is always advisable to have an all-inclusive. If 2 covers most of the body parts, it will be welcomed. Thank you.
Just to be certain, so the committee is happy with option 2 on page 7. On page 9 is the definition of removal of body parts. What we have done is there was a definition proposed by the state law advisors which we have included there.
I understand it's just the word unlawful.
Sorry, can you just repeat, sir?
I said what the state law advisors are wanting is just the word unlawful.
Unlawful.
I mean, I don't think that makes sense.
Would you prefer that the word unlawful then be removed?
No. Thinking about it, it's the issue then is if there is consent, if a trafficked victim consents to the removal of their body parts, this is as far as I understand it, trafficking for the purposes of getting their body parts. If you put the word in as unlawful, then there can be a dispute around was the removal lawful or not. Do we want to get into that debate? I mean, I'm looking at the NPA. Should they have to prove unlawfulness? Whereas, if we leave it out, it is just that this person was trafficked for the purposes of getting their body parts, and whether or not they consented to the removal of their body parts is not material. What was trafficking was that they were trafficked for the purposes of obtaining body parts from them. So let's take, a more simpler example, the kidney issues. People get trafficked into the country or trafficked from rural areas to come and supply kidneys. They consent. They say, no, it's fine, I'm short of money, got 2 kidneys, you can take one of them. Is that an unlawful removal of a kidney? Why does it matter whether it's lawful or not? What's wrong is that they were trafficked for the purposes of harvesting their kidneys. I don't know, maybe Chair, through you, the state's law advisors, as they want it, can comment, Engela.
How does the National Health Act address it while you're addressing us? Ms. Williams.
Thanks, Chair. I just want to say that unlawful we propose because previously dead means the forced removal of the body parts. So we substitute that with unlawful to provide because issues was raised regarding someone who consents to donating blood, someone who consents to donating something. So that's why we provided for unlawful. So it would be subject to what other legislation says, such as the National Health Act, if it provides for the lawful donation or the lawful removal, things like that. So that's why we substituted forced with unlawful, because we thought it would be more appropriate than the word forced.
Just through you, where is the actual crime? I mean, we're just dealing with definitions relating to body parts.
If you look at the definition of exploitation, it includes the removal of body parts.
That, am I then correct, if you read it with the crime, the main crime on page 14, so you deliver, recruit, transfer, etc., by means of various pressure, I mean, I suppose that's how you would summarize A to I, A to J, for the purposes of any manner of exploitation. Okay. So you want to get a whole lot of people so you can supply kidneys. You recruit people. Or let's say it's just looking at I on one. You go to people, you pay them for their children. You pay people to give up their children for to become kidney donors. The transportation and the sort of collection of the people then is covered under the first part of one. You've done this not through threats of harm, use of force, etc., but you've done it by paying their parents. And it's for exploitation. And the exploitation is the sale of body parts. Why does it matter? Why does that removal of the body parts have to be unlawful? Why does that element have to be added? Why is it material whether it was lawful or not?
Thank you, Chair. I just want to apologize for coming in late. I did ask to convey my apologies front. Chair, I'm just wondering whether can't we say something, bring in the concept of against the will of the person. There are two aspects. It's a person and then there's a deceased person. Can't one say means the removal or portrayed in any body apart from the person who has been trafficked against his or her will? Or bring in a concept of involuntary. I know we used the word involuntary earlier on in the bill.
And is it not another way? I mean, presumably the Health Act prohibits the... deals with the sale of body parts and regulates it. People can donate kidneys on an individual basis, but you can't make a business of it. Presumably, I don't know. So it's already a crime. What we want to is there a crime like that in the National Health Act?
If I can refer you to footnote 8 on page 9, it says we point out some sections of the National Health Act which might have a bearing on the definition, because the definition states that it must be in contravention, the removal must be in contravention of the National Health Act. For example, Section 55, in terms of Section 55, a person may not remove tissue, blood, etc. from a living person unless his or her written consent has been obtained. And then in terms of Section 56, the use of tissue and so on must only be for medical or dental purposes as prescribed. Section 58 provides that the removal of tissue and so on must only take place at a hospital or an authorized institution. And Section 59 states that only a registered medical practitioner or dentist may remove the tissue.
Yeah, is it a crime? You may not do it. Is it criminalized if you do?
We're looking at Section 89 of the National Health Act, and it doesn't seem as if those sections that I've read to you is made an offence.
The kidney, the big kidney case, people are being prosecuted for that. What are they being prosecuted under?
And the Department of Health indicated that they're in the process with their regulations, and until those regulations are in place for the provisions repealing the Human Tissue Act, the provisions of the Human Tissue Act is still operational. So the charges brought on those cases are in terms of the Human Tissue Act. And if I recall correctly, I think it is currently an offence in terms of the Human Tissue Act.
I think we need to be careful that we don't try and make new law over on issues that are outside our jurisdiction. Our concern with this bill is trafficking. It's not around the unlawful removal of body parts. What we want to pick up and criminalize is where there's trafficking involved. In other words, sort of a larger group, really. So surely we are overcomplicating this, and surely the way to deal with it would be surely just removal in contravention of the National Health Act. Removal of any body part in terms of the National Health Act, in contravention of the National Health Act. And then we don't have a situation, because one doesn't want a situation where somebody is prosecuted for doing this. The NPA then have to look at this bill, which criminalizes certain conduct relating to removal of body parts, and the National Health Act or the Tissue Act or regulations, and there's confusion where the two don't read together. So I mean, my suggestion would be let's not make new law on the issue of removing body parts. Let's take the law as it is, which would presumably be the wording then in contravention of the National Health Act, and then that forms part of exploitation. So I don't know if that makes sense. So really what I'm trying to say is that the law relating to the removal of body parts, the illegal removal of body parts stays. Where it becomes an element for trafficking, where it forms part of exploitation, is that if you traffic with these other requirements of trafficking for the purposes of organ removal, unlawful, illegal organ removal. But it seems to me that if I'm then correct, and nobody seems to be wanting to engage me on it, that you know, it would then just be simpler to refer to removal of body parts means removal of body parts in contravention of the National Health Act or the National Tissues Act. But if that's being repealed, you just need to weigh a fine. But if the National Health Act is going to cover it, and if the Tissue Act remains in place because of sections of the National Health Act that haven't come into operation or allowed, whatever, but just let's refer to existing law.
Thank you, Chair. I tend to agree with that. I wonder if we don't go even a bit broader in contravention of any law. And I'm speaking under correction. Why I'm saying that is I think there might even be something in the Witchcraft Suppression Act where you might find something here, and I don't have that act with me. So if we be as broad as possible and say in contravention of any law, but we will have a look specifically. Can't find it in the National Health Act at the moment, but we will have a focused look at the legislation, but something says to me that there's something in the Witchcraft Suppression Act as well.
Yeah, then look, I think the proposal that I'm thinking of is not unlawful removal, but the removal of any trade of any body part from a person who has been trafficked. In contravention of the of any law.
Any law, not just the national.
Well, it just seems there are more laws. I mean, I suspect that the Suppression of Witchcraft Act is a 1950s, I think it's 1950s act, but there may be others. It is wider. But I think what one just doesn't want to create is confusion, where there's already law, and we are then saying things about it. The NPA must use the existing law, and then if they want to add the charge of trafficking, if that occurred, then they use this. And the unlawful removal of body parts is dealt with in terms of existing law. The trafficking then comes in if there are other elements.
Thank you, Chair. I tend to agree with Mr. Jeffries. The effect of the matter is that in trafficking you've got elements, as explained in page 14. So the issue of the removal of body parts explains exploitation. It's not creating a separate offence as it exists in the Health Act, the Tissue Act. Here we're saying a victim has been trafficked for the removal of body parts, so we cannot use unlawful removal again. The unlawful removal, like Mr. Jeffries has said, is covered under the Health Act. So you have to remove the word unlawful there. It still remains an offence under trafficking if you traffic a person with the purpose of removing or harvesting body parts. Thanks.
Steve. Just on Mr. Jeffrey's formulation, was the removal of trade of any body parts from a person who has been trafficked in contravention of any law. Was that basically what you wanted? That must come. Yeah, that's what you said, and I think it must come back, otherwise you refer. The in contravention of any law must be at the beginning.
Okay. Removal of any body part in contravention.
Isn't that amount to unlawfully? If anything done in contravention of the law is done unlawfully.
Okay.
I can have a seat.
Please.
On page 11, the definition of victim of trafficking, we had a look at it again, and it appears that the reference to section 19(8) should be a reference to section 19(10). Section 19 is now the clause dealing with the reporting of an adult victim of trafficking. We initially had, after an assessment in terms of section 19(8), but the provincial head issue a letter to the victim of trafficking in terms of section 19(10). On page 16, the committee asked us to consider the words that were inserted, suspect or reasonably to have known or suspected. We had to reconsider those words. I don't know whether Ms. Williams she indicated that she had a look at that, whether she would like to say something on that.
Chair? So, before Ms. Williams comes in, may I just say something? I did speak to the, because there seemed to be a bit of confusion last time about what the views of the NPA were at that particular time. So I went back to the NPA and I asked them, and I think I must just put on the table that they feel strongly that the word suspected should stay. But I'm going to ask Ms. William.
Thanks, Chair. We've looked at case law, sent the document yesterday. We've just looked at case law and where it has been used. It has been used in lots of other legislation, existing legislation. And also in case law, we found that when it's using case law, if we go back to clause 2.2, they speak about, for the purpose of this act, a person ought reasonably to have known or suspected a fact. When the court interpreted that, they interpreted that in respect of the terrorism legislation. And when they looked at, they never distinguished between ought reasonably to have known and suspected a fact. Because if you look at here, the same meaning is given to both words, both expressions. Ought reasonably to have known or suspected a fact is the conclusion that he or she ought to have reached are those which would have been reached by a reasonably diligent and vigilant person having both the general knowledge, skill, training, and experience that may reasonably be expected of the person in his or her position, and the general knowledge, skill, training, and experience that he or she in fact has. So the court looked at those terms together, but they never distinguished between that. There's a difference between ought reasonably to have known or suspected a fact.
Yeah, I mean, from your chair, from your...
Assuming, Steve.
From your research then, has anyone been convicted Firstly, has there been any attempt to prosecute somebody for having committed a crime on the basis that they should have, or that they suspected that a crime had been committed? Let's just leave out ought reasonably. Just say that they suspected. Well, no, let's include both. Suspected or ought reasonably to have suspected. Has anyone been prosecuted, number one, in terms of the case law you've looked at, for that, or has everybody just simply been prosecuted on the basis of known or ought reasonably to have been known?
Thanks, Chair. In respect of the terrorism legislation, the court looked at the meaning of it and it had exactly verbatim the same clause that we have under 2, and the court interpreted the exact words. The court didn't use the word suspect. They had here suspected a fact. So a fact would relate to the offence in terms of which they're referring to. So the court looked at what reason we to have known or suspected a fact, suspected that issue. The court used that exact same wording. They didn't distinguish a wording to suspicion or to suspect. I've prepared a document just giving a brief description of the cases which I gave to Romano, which you can maybe just circulate also. And they have been able to convict on that. The court looked at the circumstances, they looked at, they used the subjective test.
So they convicted on the basis of new, suspected, or reasonably to have known or suspected?
Yeah. If the offense states knows, which is 2.1, and then, like, as we see in the bill, it says knows, or ought reasonably to have known or suspected. Ought reasonably to have known and suspected if the court is satisfied with the conditions as stated in 2.2. If they take into account that, if you look at the one case regarding the terrorism legislation where they looked at the particular set of circumstances, they looked at the, they found that the accused ought reasonably to have known because it was in respect of the Boeremacht trial that they had. They were escapees. The trial was, it was on the news, it was in the media that they were charged with terrorism. So therefore they ought reasonably to have known or suspected that they were terrorists in that sense. And then they looked at the knowledge, the skills and expertise and the fact that they were hiding on the farm. He should have known because they used vehicles which was hidden on the farm, all those things. So the court looked at that phrase together, ought reasonably to have known or suspected a fact. It didn't distinguish, and also we never introduced another possible interpretation could be a person ought reasonably to have known or ought reasonably to have suspected a fact. The court didn't bring in that interpretation. It just stuck to a person ought reasonably to have known or suspected a fact. And then we see the definition, the same definition is given to both expressions. So therefore the court looked at it together. The court didn't distinguish between the two, so
basically what you're saying is, I mean, it would be useful to see the document. It's a pity Mr. Romano didn't see fit to distribute it. But I mean, basically what I understand you're saying is it's in our law already in terms of other offences, the whole concept of known, suspected, or reasonably to have known or suspected.
Yeah.
And if that is the case, then let's keep it the same. And let's agree with the NPA on this one.
Thanks, Jay. And also there's been lots of other legislation, existing legislation, that has that exact phrase verbatim. And the courts have gave interpretation to that phrase jointly. Thanks.
No, Chair, I agree. The Financial Intelligence Centre Act and POCA both use those same terms. And I would suggest we follow the NPAs and the legal advice and we keep the two words in, Chair. Thank you.
Okay, Chairperson, just to stay with that topic, we have also inserted after the word knows, I'm referring now to clause 7, after knows the word suspects, has been inserted. I've heard what Ms. Williams is saying, and I don't think the problem for us is with the ought visibly to have known or suspected that we have dealt with. But with regard to the word suspect, if we look at the interpretation that was given in the Chaban case, I think it is a case in England, but the definition of the interpretation of the word suspicion in that case was endorsed by the Supreme Court of Appeal in several cases. And I was just wondering if you have a look at the words knows or suspect, and you look at our clause 2.1.
Clause 2.1.
2.1a says a person is regarded as having knowledge of a fact if A, that person has the actual knowledge of the fact, and then B says the court is satisfied that the person believes that there is a reasonable possibility of the existence of the fact, and Roman 2, the person has failed to obtain information to confirm the existence of that fact. And if you look at in the Chaban case, it was said suspicion in its ordinary meaning is a state of conjecture or surmise where proof is lacking, and then it says in inverted commas, I suspect but I cannot prove. If we apply that to our clause, then saying with regard to B1, the person believes that there is a reasonable possibility of the existence of the facts. In other words, I understand it to mean that he suspects. And then in 2, the person failed to obtain information, meaning that I cannot prove. Whether that will then also not make the use of the word suspects there unnecessary, because it will be it falls under the word knows in any event.
Because I understand it, our from what Ms. Stain, Ms. Williams, sorry, has said is that our existing law is knows or ought reasonably to have known or suspected. Okay. So the issue we're now dealing with is we've agreed on the known or suspect, or reasonably to have known or suspected. The issue is, do you need knows, suspects, or reasonably to have known or suspected? And if we put that in, that will be new. Under 2.1, we've quite carefully defined what knows means and what ought reasonably to have known or suspected means. We haven't said anything about what suspected means, which I think then is a gap. And I think I agree what's the point. So it seems to make more sense to have it knows or reasonably to have known or suspected. And that the second or this first suspect is going to be confusing. And if we do put it in, then we're going to have to under 2.1 say what knowing means.
Thanks, Chair. I agree with Mr. Jeffrey, because the courts have interpreted those three phrases. Suspects would be introducing something new. And even though she said there's been foreign case law interpreting it, I propose that we do what we currently have in existing legislation, with the jurisprudence has been developed in respect of those three terms. And this bill, also the interpretation clearly defines what that is to mean, so someone is easily able to identify when there is in fact an offence.
Then the proposal would be that 7 reads knows, delete suspect, and it reads knows or ought reasonably to have known or suspected.
Honourable members, are we agreed? Okay.
Thanks, Chair. Then I think we've left the offences, the wording, we haven't changed it, so we'll just go through all the offences again and where appropriate make those changes in all the offences.
Good.
Thank you. If I may proceed with regard to clause 8, Mr. Bassett has indicated, we also have the word suspect there in 8.1c.
Yes, I
which
see
I gather
that
must come out.
The Chair, just on Mr. Bassett's point, I think Ms. Stain can just leave out suspects, not refer us to suspects any further. You'll clean it up.
Because he has pointed that out, yeah.
Chair, and as you have already indicated this morning, I haven't received that a proposal from MWEB and ISPA. I left before it reached my office yesterday. I don't know how the committee would like to deal then with clause 8, because that is one of the clauses that they are having problems with.
Honourable members, I've asked Mr. Romano to, in addition to the opinion that we've received from Ms. Williams, is to also distribute the document from MWEB and the internet service providers for their request for a formal hearing.
Here I note that if it's then clause 8, 2 and 2, 3 and 4, that we have not amended it in any substance. So I anyway, let's look at the email, but it appears as though they've woken up 2 years later.
Thank you, Chair. On page 18, with regard to clause 11, liability of persons for offences under this chapter, you will see that subclause 11.1 reads, it is no defence to a charge of contravening section 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 or 10, and we have added 9.1, or we have excluded 9.3, because clause 9.3 deals with the failure to report a suspected victim of trafficking, and I don't think that was the idea that that offence must be included here, and that we should focus on the more serious offences.
Okay. Honourable members? Okay.
On page 19, in clause 12, there's a footnote 18. When we went through the bill, we tried to use the term under this chapter to be in line with similar other provisions, and we have taken out in terms of this act and just referred to under this chapter, because that is still under chapter 2. Coming to page 21, chapter 3, and that is where the Department of Home Affairs comes in with regard to the provisions that we have indicated there. I don't know how you would like to deal with that.
Jeffrey?
Yeah, I'd want to suggest that we don't deal with it now. I mean, we need to have further engagement with Home Affairs, and we need to involve NPA and the police, because there's two conflicting concerns which are in conflict. The one is Home Affairs' desire not to have people abusing the permit regime. The other is the necessity on the part of the law enforcement agencies to ensure that victims of trafficking that are required for assisting investigations and giving evidence are able to stay. So I don't think we can deal with much here. We need to further engage with Home Affairs.
Can we get ideas to the progress in those discussions? I fully appreciate the concerns from Home Affairs and the possibility of abuse, but we just need to get an indication of when these discussions are going to be finalised.
Well, that's a bit difficult.
And is it a stalemate? Do we have to come in and say,
no,
well, this is the way we want to go?
No, there won't be a stalemate, Mr. Swart. It's just that our experience is that, let me give you an example. The DG of Home Affairs was in this committee and gave certain undertakings and reached certain agreements. And when this was reported to his minister, she shot them down. Now, under the circumstances, it's best then that we have a meeting where all these political heads are present, so that they all understand their individual roles and then how this act will function or be implemented insofar as it affects all of them. That's all we have to do. How long it takes, our view is that it shouldn't take long. We had thought of trying to get them together now in this next 2 weeks. I don't think it's going to work, failing which it will be very early in the new year. Mr. Bassett.
Thank you, Chair. If we're not going to discuss these provisions, I think our footnotes here do give the gist of our meeting with the Department of Home Affairs, so that can be looked at. Meeting on the 30th of November with officials of Home Affairs, and what was discussed is all in the footnote.
All right.
I think there are quite a few footnotes. 20,
22,
25. Yeah, they're scattered all over this chapter, yes. So what I can also say on this chapter, we brought it forward as was suggested. We made proposals about headings and all that sort of thing. And as far as we could, we've given effect to the discussions of the committee where we could, indications of possibilities that we can look at.
All right, let's leave it there and move on.
You can I then proceed to chapter 4.
Page 26.
26. Going to page 28, footnote 43. Originally, we had that we provided that the police official may, where necessary, enter premises without a warrant, and then B, must deal with the child in terms of section 110(4) of the Children's Act, and then we had or may place that child in temporary safe care in terms of section 152 of the Children's Act. But looking at it again, it states that paragraph B, in terms of paragraph B, the police official must deal with that child, but the word or at the end of that paragraph creates the impression that the police official may choose not to do what is required in B, and it is suggested that we use the word and. Can I proceed? With regard to footnote 44, we just inserted a reference to clause 22(2)(b) to provide for the instance where the child is referred by a prosecutor to the Provincial Department of Social Development. Clause 22 is the old clause 19.
Okay.
With regard to footnote 45, we were requested to provide in that subclause for information to be obtained from the South African police. And we have indicated that we first had a report, but we think there might be confusion if we refer to a report, and then the Minister of Police might have to make regulations, and that is why we are saying prescribed information. The Minister of Social Development can then make the regulations as to what would be prescribed information. With regard to footnote 46, we are referring here to we have deleted the old clause 17(1), but the committee asked us to reinstate that. We have moved it to this clause dealing with the reporting of a child. So it's no longer under a separate clause 17, but it is now in clause 7. With regard to clause to footnote 47 in clause 19, the committee asked us to relook at the two options that we provided the last time we were here. What we have done there is to reinstate the wording regarding the immigration officer, the labour inspector, social worker, and so on. But just to add before that, despite any law, policy, or code of conduct prohibiting the disclosure of personal information, and then those officials would need to report. And then the option there with regard to subclause 1A is a generalist, any person who in the execution of his or her duties comes into contact with an adult person who is suspected of being a victim of trafficking must, despite any law, policy or code of conduct prohibiting the disclosure of personal information, immediately report that knowledge or suspicion to a police official for investigation. So the committee must give us guidance on that aspect, please.
Honourable members. Chair, from the department's point of view, I think we like the option, because I think it's
that's on page 29.
Yeah.
The difference is basically the law specifically referring to immigration officers, labour inspectors, social workers, social service professionals, medical practitioners, nurses, traditional health practitioners, traditional healers, or traditional leaders. Who come into contact. So if we have left the option, then is the second option is any person who in the execution of his or her duties. The difference then is that the option is wider, because if you've left somebody out, then they're not covered. I suppose the advantage with the wording as it was before is that people, these officials in these categories, can see that the law does apply to them, but how many of them will read the bill or the act will probably be negligible, and one would expect the police, social development to issue instructions to their officials to deal with this. So it does seem to me to be that the option of the any person in the execution of his or her duties is preferable.
Which one is preferable? Sorry?
Yeah. Agreeing with Mr. Bassett.
Honourable members? Good. Right.
Kosi Holomisa, who's got a personal interest in them, or your traditional leader, so you have a duty to disclose. Is this complaining that MPs are not under the first are not listed?
can go now to page 31. There's a footnote 48. We have dealt with this provision also in terms of the previous clause dealing with the reporting of children. That is just only to say that after taking into account the prescribed information obtained from the South African Police Service.
Okay.
On page 33, footnote 49, we have also referred to this provision, the child victim of trafficking found in the Republic. On page 33, sir, footnote 49, it's right on top. That has now been moved to the clause dealing with the reporting of children.
Okay, it's been shifted. All right.
On page 34, clause 23, we suggest that the heading should read unauthorized access to and disclosure of information.
Yes, that sounds better.
On page 35, footnote 50, is just an indication that the provisions of this chapter have moved to the new chapter 3, of course with the necessary amendments.
Okay.
On page 38, clause 25, there's a footnote 51.
Page 48?
38. Last time we were here, the committee indicated that the consultation process involving ministers appears to be too onerous and should be amended, and therefore we have deleted the part dealing with the consultation of all the various ministers.
All right.
On page 39, but I think we have dealt with this before, is just to indicate that subclause 4A was the previous clause 26 of the introduced bill dealing with the information. Yes, and B and C as well.
All right.
On page 40. Clause 27, access to program offered by accredited organization. At the last meeting in this committee, the Department of Home Affairs suggests the insertion of the words and the visitor's visa as provided for in section 21 sub 1 to follow after the words issued with a letter of recognition. We are of the view that the letter of recognition will be issued to a victim before a visitor's visa entitling him to access to the programs, such as counseling or rehabilitation. So it was not quite sure to us why we should refer here to a visitor's visa. We would just like the committee's guidance on that.
The whole Home Affairs stuff. We need to
I can say in our meeting, and Sietse can just bear me out, I think I'm correct in saying when we had our meeting on the 30th and they said we needn't worry about that proposal. Is that correct, Sietse? Yeah. I think we cleared it with them, so I don't think that's really on the table.
So they're happy with the visitor's visa? I mean with the letter of recognition?
Yes, Chair, we did discuss and indicated that the letter of recognition serves another purpose, so we wouldn't have a concern on that. Thank you.
Okay, fine.
Going to page 41, clause 55 only indicates that we have moved those clauses. Footnote 56 is the same.
Okay.
On page 44, there's footnote 57, is also the amendment there to bring the wording in line with other provisions to refer under chapter 2 of this act. lunch are we going to? The repatriation, will we leave that? Mr. Chair, coming to page 45, clause 31, the repatriation of victims of trafficking, I assume that we will also look at this clause then at a later stage.
Maybe this is one of those, I don't know. Though, Chair, in our meeting, if I may, and maybe Tietz can come in as well, I don't know whether there are huge challenges like the previous chapter on these clauses. But I don't want to speak on behalf of Home Affairs. Dealing with the words return or repatriate.
Thank you. I think there are no concerns with regard to the wedding. I think the major concerns are only on the Chapter 3 provisions. Thank you.
This is an unfair question, but the requirements at the start of 31 are already relating to foreign children are already in our law in the Children's Act. Okay, that's about assessing the DG of social development. And then Home Affairs didn't have a problem with so this is where the victim of trafficking is to be returned, but there's a requirement in the case of children that social development check on these issues in the home country, and then that's in our law already. And then there's a requirement now for adult victims that there's also a check done by Home Affairs on the return. Now I see the issue with sub 3. 31(1)(b) and 3 refer, well, seeing you've put this requirement that there must be a check, you've then got to have something to say if the check doesn't work. And that's the purposes of 31(1)(b) and 3. I see the footnote is the Minister of Home Affairs does not want victims to use Section 31(2)(b) of the Immigration Act. What then happens if this check is done for children, as it must be done already, and the check is done for adults, and it is found that the conditions are not cannot be met? What then happens? I mean, through you, Chair, that's to Home Affairs.
If I may, Chair.
Yes.
I think the way in which Minister has approached the discussions would be that for prosecution and maybe investigation prosecution, why would we need to keep people or issue the Section 31(2)(b)? But then going further beyond the stage of investigation prosecution where we have to repatriate, we did not get to that stage because I think we got stuck right in the beginning. But the impression would then be generally the Section 31(2)(b) will be a problem for Minister, but then with engagement, I think as the Chair had said, we'll need an engagement with the Minister. I think that could also be put before the Minister to say, but then there will be different stages wherein the victim will go through, and which one would generally Minister disagree with everything that has got to do with Section 31(2). But that's the impression that Minister had given. That
I'm not talking about the requirement of having victims to assist with investigations. I'm dealing with a separate matter, which is the one under 31, and that's the repatriation of a victim of trafficking from the Republic. So 31.1 is already in our law. Okay, it's already in the Children's Act, that before a foreign child who's a victim of trafficking can be repatriated, the DG of Social Development must give due consideration to the best interests of the child, the safety of the child, the availability of care arrangements, and the safety of the child in the country to which the child is to be returned or repatriated, the possibility that the child may be harmed or killed. Okay, so that's in our law. Harmed, killed, or trafficked again is what's in our law. Now, the problem is, what happens when these factors are not met? That according to the DG of Home Affairs, there's a possibility that the child may be harmed or killed in their country if they're returned. We've got to say something about what then is the next step. That's what's covered under B. Okay. So there has to be a response. I'm not expecting it now from Home Affairs. And as I said, remember 31.1 is already in our law. But you've got to then assist the Director General of Social Development and the officials of Home Affairs where they reach a situation where it's not the child may be harmed if they're returned. You've got to provide for something, some procedure to be followed. Home Affairs needs to make an input as to what is that procedure. Then when you come to 31.2, which is adults, and that relates to Home Affairs, and that the DG had said at the start of the meeting you didn't have any problem with it. This, though, is new law. Similar to the children, but this time it's the DG of Home Affairs that there must be a check. And it's not a bad provision because you can't just send somebody into the unknown. But you then also have to provide, and that is what 3 does, for what then happens if the conditions are not suitable. And you need to be able to make an input on that.
Thanks. I've noted that. I think we'll then go back and just indicate that what the Mr. Jeffries has indicated as well as the committee. Thank you.
Okay. All right.
If I may proceed, on page 47, clause 33, I think we have dealt with this at the previous meetings at footnote 62, where the Department of Home Affairs suggested that we delete the word suspected, but it was pointed out to them that we need the word there as a foreign country might repatriate a South African citizen based on that country's own processes. But which might not be adequate for declaring a person in terms of as a victim of trafficking in terms of our legislation. Clause 33B, there's a footnote 63, that was amended to, as suggested by the Department of Home Affairs.
Okay.
On page 48, footnote 64, just an indication that this clause was moved from clause 25. On page 49, right at the bottom, footnote 65, an indication that this clause is now found at clause 44.
Okay.
On page 55, coming to chapter 9, administration of the Act, clause 40, there's a footnote 66. there's also a requirement that the minister must, after consultation with various other ministers, approve a national policy framework. We did not delete the references here to all the ministers, as it is with regard to the drafting of the national policy framework, and it might be necessary for the minister to consult in this regard with the other ministers.
Okay, so this one stays in.
If the committee is satisfied with that, there's just one other thing. You might remember at the previous meeting, the suggestion was made that the persons from SARS also be included in this process. I have discussed the matter with a person of SARS, and they indicated they also suggest that they be included in the consultation processes. So in terms of clause 40, the Minister of Finance must then be also added as one of the ministers to be consulted. Yeah, that will be then from a customs point of view.
Okay.
On page 57.
57.
57, yes, clause 41. Also with regard to the functionaries that need to be consulted by the Director General of Justice, they need to include the Commissioner of SARS here from the point from customs official. On page 59, subclause 41.4. There's footnote 67. The committee indicated last time that subclause 4 should be deleted as it is already provided for in clause 43.1b. We are suggesting, however, that the clause should be retained as it will be in line with similar provisions elsewhere in the bill, where something is to be prescribed by a minister, for example, in clause 24.2. Dealing with that the Minister of Social Development must prescribe the system for the accreditation of organizations, and it is also repeated in clause 43.3H. We feel that clause 43 can therefore be seen as a sort of a summary of all the provisions in the bill containing the prescribed actions. On page 60, with regard to clause 43, the regulations,
Chair, just on clause 42, again, in line with, I think there was a suggestion that all the ministers were reports to Parliament. I think the question was raised whether all those ministers shouldn't be deleted. We said for the national policy framework, perhaps it's important, or we suggested that it's perhaps important for the ministers to be kept there, and the same view is held here. We'd just like the committee's view, or should we take all those ministers out in the reports to Parliament?
Leave them in.
Leave
honourable
them
members?
In.
Leave them in.
On page 16, clause 43, the regulations. On the 16th of November, the committee indicated that we should divide subclause 1 into two distinct paragraphs, and that has been done. Paragraph A provides that the minister must make regulations regarding the manner in which prosecutors must refer suspected victims of trafficking, and then B, the minister may make regulations regarding the establishment on regulation of a mechanism to facilitate the implementation of the Act.
Honourable members, okay. All right.
On page 61, footnote 71, depending on the meeting and the decisions to be taken with regard to the recovery and reflection period and the other provisions in Chapter 3, we might need to take out paragraphs B and C.
Mr. Jeffrey?
The issue of the setting out of the regulations. And I think the issue would be there needs to be clarity. Things should be set out once. I'm going back to 41.4, which read, you know, where you have the footnote around, you're proposing it stay there. And as you said, it's consistent with other aspects of the bill. And I think it is useful to, as is happening here in each section, to specify things and then say the minister may make regulations. What you don't want is a repeat, where you repeat it all again later. And if you look at what you've done inadvertently with 41.4, you've said the minister may make regulations relating to the establishment and regulating the functioning of a mechanism. Then if you look at 43.3H, you say the minister must make regulations regarding the circumstances in which accredited organizations qualify for financial assistance as provided for in 24.2b. So, I mean, I know you've been under pressure, but the one is a may, the other is a must. Okay, it's a mistake. But that's what I'm saying is the way it should work as far as regulations is that the regulating making power should be really set out once, so that if you set it out twice, you can make mistakes as you've made here, and then there's confusion, is it a must or is it a may? And what is different under the procedural aspects under the regulation aspect is the procedures to be followed. I mean, I don't know if you're with me. I know it's difficult, but what I'm trying to prevent is a situation where the regulation making power is repeated twice. So I don't know if you're following me. That's then what you've done with 41.4. You've put in the regulating power there. I agree with you, it makes sense to have it at the end of that section because it then completes the section. The problem comes in is then when you repeat it under 43.3H, you've repeated it differently. You've made it a must, not a may.
Chair, 43.3H is Minister of Social Development.
Yes. So which minister is
41.4? Ours, Minister of Justice, is 43.1B. And
41.4? I'm talking about 41.4. Which minister is that?
Which minister is that? That's the Justice Minister, and we haven't said Justice Minister because that's defined.
And you say it's repeated in 43.3H.
43.3.8 relates to the responsibilities of the Minister of Social Development as far as regulations are concerned.
Then what are you referring to in this footnote where you say provides...
I think in the footnote is just to give an example. There's confusion, maybe. No, but that was just to use an example.
Okay, now I misread it then. Oh, you've got it under... you've included it actually under 43.1b, which is then just a general. Okay, all right, I see.
What... If the committee feels that we should do it that way, that what we've done, and I'm referring to the child justice and sexual offences, where you've got in the substance of the bill, the minister, or in the prescribed manner or whatever, then the empowering provisions or enabling provisions, normally at the end, we try and have a complete list of everything that must or may be prescribed. But if the committee feels that we should try and avoid that doubling up. At times it might be difficult because I think Mr. Jeffrey indicated clause 41.4, it does round off that that section, and I feel it might be necessary to say it in the section itself that the minister has a discretion to create some sort of body if the need arises.
Yeah, I think I'd misread the section. I think it's fine.
Can we move on, honourable members? Okay.
On page 61, footnote 72, it's right on top the paragraph D. It is just to bring that in line with the amendment is in line with clause 31.2b2. I think we've changed the word return to repatriated. Footnote 73 just indicates that we have deleted the references to the various ministers.
Okay.
On page 62, footnote 74, it is in subclause 4, regarding regulations to be made, must be submitted to Parliament for approval 60 days prior to publication. During our meeting on with the Department of Home Affairs on the 30th, it was sort of indicated that the Minister of Home Affairs does not want regulations to be approved by Parliament.
It's put a bit strongly. Just the question was raised that the Minister of Home Affairs will get back and just
Chair, what is the procedure general or policy regarding regulations? And they're supposed to come to Parliament for noting or something like that.
Chair, I think different bills or legislation have dealt with differently, and I think it's dealt with possibly differently in different portfolio committees. I think it depends on the nature of the subject matter. There are places in our legislation where our committees felt very strongly that the stuff must come to Parliament for good reason for approval, and there are others that must merely be submitted to Parliament, not necessarily for approval, but in terms of the Interpretation Act, in Section 17, every time any subordinate legislation is made, a minister must submit, not necessarily the regulations themselves or the subordinate legislation, but a list of the subordinate legislation that's been published, so that there is a mechanism in place for Parliament to take note of all subordinate legislation that is made. But there have been a number of instances where Parliament and this committee has felt strongly, and I think with good reason, that stuff must come here for approval.
I mean, the, with regulations, Parliament delegates the powers to make laws to ministers, so it can handle that delegation as it wants to, and it varies depending on the importance of the regulations concerned. So in the Child Justice Act, there's various ways, the sort of approval, one, you just give a straight delegation, the minister can make regulations. Then there's a requirement of parliamentary approval. Then there's a requirement of what's called deemed approval, where it is within Parliament for a particular period, and if Parliament doesn't say anything, then it's deemed to be approved. It doesn't make sense to require ministers all ministers bar one to follow a certain procedure with regulations.
If I may suggest, I think because of the importance of this legislation and the interest that it has aroused in a number of circles in the country, I think let's provide for the regulations being brought to the attention of Parliament without necessarily requiring that they be approved.
You want it to be approved?
No.
Not just
for Parliament.
Just to be tabled.
Yeah.
Well, Chair, approval, I think that gives Parliament the space. And I think the experience with the Child Justice Bill Act was that it was quite essential that was in fact even stronger. That was, we had to approve it. This at least gives Parliament the opportunity to, the deemed approval is the middle way. It gives, and given that there's a number I think the way it's phrased with the deemed approval is adequate.
Is her difficulty not the fact that we are giving her 60 days?
No, the 60 days is to us. I don't know. I mean, it seems that she doesn't want any approval. She doesn't want any approval by Parliament.
Thank you. I think the issue is approval.
Oh, is it approval?
It's approval. But I think the experience we have had with this was with our two bills recently, the immigration, the refugees. I think Minister was in one of the meetings in the portfolio committee was present, saying if the power is given to Minister to make regulations, why then still need approval? But if it's for submission for inputs or comments, that would not be an issue. Thank you.
We've had a long debate about delegated legislation.
Yeah.
Advocate Olumisa?
I just still want to make the point, Chairperson, that the deemed approval procedure is the midway. It doesn't subject the minister to having get regulations actually dealt with in the manner that we deal with legislation. But it gives an opportunity to Parliament to apply its mind to see if indeed these regulations are going to get the desired effect. It gives the public also an understanding that Parliament is indeed taking this particular law seriously enough to satisfy itself, that to give itself the opportunity to know how it is going to be implemented.
The authority to legislate lies with Parliament, and regulations is part of that process. And so Parliament always reserves the right to decide whether to grant any minister firstly the right to make regulations, and then thereafter Parliament reserves the right to whether to decide whether those regulations must either be tabled and then or approved. I'm not sure that any minister can decide that no, Parliament shouldn't approve. It's an option that Parliament chooses to exercise. And so, without going into the whole question of separation of powers, with respect, I'm not sure that she is in a position to say that she doesn't want Parliament to approve. The deemed approval there is, as the members have pointed out, is the middle road. But maybe we'll raise that when we meet. Okay? We'll flag that.
So if I can proceed. Still on page 62, there's footnote 75, just indicating that we've moved this clause from clause 36 of the introduced bill now to this clause. At the last meeting, the committee asked us to consider the use of the words where applicable and relevant, where we give the DG of Justice the duty to consult. We suggest that we use the words where necessary and relevant, and you will see it is there in the second line that it reads the Director General Justice and Constitutional Development must, after consultation, where such consultation is necessary and relevant, with the National Commissioner and then all the other functionaries. There is also an option with regard to subclause 1A, we have changed the wording there to read the Director General of Justice and Constitutional Development must issue directives regarding the following matters with which all police officials and so on must comply. After consultation with the functionaries mentioned there, I don't know that the committee must give guidance as to which of the options it prefers. I also wish then to indicate that in line with the previous discussions, we will then also need to add the Commissioner of SARS as one of the functionaries.
Chair, just to assist the wording, the two options are really just where the consultation, the wording relating to consultation comes in. In the first option, it's right at the beginning, and in the second option, the wording is virtually the same, but the words where such consultation is necessary and relevant really is moved to the back.
But then it also needs to be borne in mind that we are to request that it should read where applicable and relevant. So members must also decide whether they're happy with what's in front of them. It's fine? Okay. But which option? No, but which option of the two? Sorry. They're both necessary and relevant. But are you with me? You've got one option on page 62 and then another one on
63.
One is the issue of where such consultation is necessary.
That's right. That's what I said.
What is the
I prefer it at the end. For me, it reads a bit. Yes, it's the DG Justice must, after consultation, where such consultation is necessary with and relevant with the National Commissioner, whereas the other one flows, the DG Justice must issue directives regarding the following matters with which all officials, etc., must comply. After consultation, the option is the DG Justice must issue directives regarding the following matters with which all police officials must comply in the execution of their functions in terms of this act after consultation with so-and-so where such consultation is necessary and relevant. A much of a muchness.
Page 63, honourable members. Okay. Not really, no.
Sorry, Chair. If I can just come in there, I think maybe it would also be to add to that where the DG of Justice deems that such consultation is necessary and relevant. Because at times you may find one of the other people who wanted to be consulted deems it necessary and relevant, and the DG may not think so. Then they're going to say you should have consulted because it was necessary and relevant. So if you provide it, the DG decides whether it's necessary and relevant. May I make it more clear?
Mr. Jeffrey?
I think that's going too far because the clause is basically an opt-out where officials do not respond. Okay? So if you do have an official ahead of a body that is wanting to respond, then they should have the opportunity to respond. The reason for putting in the proviso of where such consultation is necessary and relevant was to enable the DG of Justice not to consult where it wasn't really necessary. But if somebody feels it's necessary, then they should be consulted. So I don't like giving the power to the DG of Justice. I prefer it as it is, which is then left up more open. Because you don't want a situation where the DG of Justice wants to make directives relating to the police, and for some reason the DG of Justice decides it's not necessary and relevant to consult the police, and the police say yes it is, and the DG of Justice says no, it's my power, I'm doing it. So I don't think we want to get there.
So we leave it as it is.
With the relevant necessary.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
And that option will be carried through to all the other sub clauses where the consultation is required.
If I can proceed. Thank you, sir. I'm still on page 63, paragraph B, at the bottom of that page. The minister must submit all directives provided for in paragraph A to Parliament 30 days before they are issued. It previously read, and must, after the expiry of the 30-day period, publish them in the Gazette. I think there was a suggestion by the Department of Home Affairs at the last meeting that this requirement be removed, as the directives are for the use of officials and will be very costly to publish. But the other concern was that why should the minister be, if the minister's duty to place the directives on the website of whatever department, and therefore we are suggesting that the minister must submit all directives as provided for in paragraph A to Parliament, but that the specific Director General, in this case Justice and Constitutional Development, must publish the directives on the website of the department. That will then also be relevant for the other functionaries.
Change is chair here, and I don't know what the committee feels about it. The Department of Home Affairs said that it'd be very expensive, I understand, and then their argument is that it's intended for internal use mainly. I don't know what the committee feels. I think it's important that they come to Parliament. I don't know what the committee feels about, rather than publishing them in the Gazette, but placing them on the website of the department in all cases.
Mr. Jeffrey?
Chair, the fact that they relate to officials, I mean, it's directives for how officials are going to deal with victims of trafficking. So there's, I think, great public interest in that issue. I mean, that people need to know. I think what one wants is an issue of certainty, and one gets that. I mean, the publication in the Gazette does then mean you've got an official document which has been gazetted. So that's why there's always been publication in the Gazette. You know, I hear the issue of expense, which nobody else has raised before. Maybe Home Affairs is more concerned about its budget than other departments. And I do think, you know, we do need to be moving on, but the key thing is that there's a need for certainty. So I think tabling in Parliament is essential, because that gives that certainty, and that's a hard copy. And then the availability, I would have thought the availability on the website of that table document is then adequate.
Thanks, Chair. I think the concern, tabling in Parliament is not an issue, but the concern was more about cost in terms of publication in the Gazette. That I think we, depending on the number of pages we indicated last time, that simply publishing about two pages will cost you about 2,000 rands or so, which is, I think, for us, we are more concerned about the pocket. Thank you.
As the State Printing Works is still a subsection of Home Affairs, isn't it? Or have you outsourced or sold off?
Does it cost that much?
Yeah, I think, just to give an example,
1,000 rand a page.
We are making a publication of two pages plus a cover. Well, it's an extraordinary gazette, but it's 3,000 rands. But if it's not an ordinary, extraordinary would be about 7. And just for information, Government Printing Works is a component on its own. Mm. It only falls within Home Affairs, just for the sake of the budget vote and issues. But in terms of operations, we don't even hold on top of them. They charge us a normal fee for a production of a passport.
So who do they account to?
They account to our minister, but they, as an independent, it's a government component.
Independent business unit.
They fall under government. They're not a state-owned enterprise. Presumably the head of the Government Printing Works accounts to the Minister of Home Affairs.
Yes, but in terms of the functioning, for example, the DG of Home Affairs would not have a say on anything that is dealt with by the GPW. It's only they'll account through to Minister what they've done with the budget that they've been given. But in terms of operations, we don't have a hold onto them as a department. But accountability, yes, it goes through to Minister.
And they are audited by the Auditor General?
Yes.
And do they come to Parliament and make presentations?
Yes, they do.
To the Home Affairs Committee?
Yes.
1,000 rands a page. Wow. Okay. Well, they've dug their own grave, as it were.
But Chair, there seems to be agreement on tabling in Parliament and then publication by the DG of Justice publication on the website.
Yeah. The point I'm trying to make is that once people pick up on this, they're all going to be doing the same, and the Government Printing Works is going to be in trouble. But, well, okay, so be it.
The rest of the clause basically deal with the same issues that we have been through, that the words necessary and relevant and where it must be placed. And then as well as the the publishing of the directives on the relevant websites. Yeah, and then the duties of the minister and the DG. On page 68, subclause 10, the bill originally only provided for the National Commissioner of the South African Police, the NDPP, and the Directors General of Home Affairs, Labour and Social Development to develop training courses. But in view of the amendments to the bill, we have added the Director General Justice and Constitutional as also one of the functionaries there to develop training courses on the directives.
Okay. Honourable members? Fine.
On page 69, that is clause 45, 4, footnote, we have amended the clauses in terms of which a director general may not delegate a power or assign a duty. That would be 15 and 16, which are the ones that will be discussed with Home Affairs. If I can just refer you to the footnote 86, provision was originally made that the powers and duties of a DG in terms of old clause 36, that is now clause 44, dealing with national instructions and directives, clause 37, now clause 38, dealing with the legitimacy and validity of documents, and the old clause 38, which is now clause 39, dealing with an annual report on abuse or deliberate neglect of a child and findings to be reported may not be delegated. It was suggested that that the DG of Home Affairs powers in terms of the new clause 15 and 16 dealing with the recovery and reflection period and the visitor's visa may also not be delegated. And then in addition, it is suggested that the powers in clause 31, it is repatriation of a victim from the Republic, and clause 41, the coordination of responsibilities, functions and duties relating to the implementation of the Act, should also not be delegated. And the committee's guidance on that suggestion is sought.
Honourable members?
I may just mention to the committee that the different departments don't have a problem with this provision.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. On page 70, footnote 87, that is basically the same.
All right.
And that brings us to the end of the bill.
Is that it?
Okay, then the schedule is also still subject to quite a few changes depending on the outcome of the discussions with Home Affairs.
All right, fine. So, honourable members. Yes, where do we go? Mr. Jeffrey.
Can we not go back to Clause 8 and seeing we have got the Internet Service Providers Association, the MWeb.
Okay, have you read it?
I've read it.
You want time, Mr. Swat?
Well, Chair, no, look, it, the issue basically is MWeb. The prevention of trafficking and combating of trafficking came to MWeb's attention in late 2011. This is a letter to you dated,
yesterday.
Serious concerns about the implications and including significant concerns about the bill's constitutionality and then how they're trying to deal with responding. Now, I do think that it should be said that this is a 2010 bill which has been in the public It was introduced early 2010. It's been in the public domain for some time, and really we cannot, I mean, the bill was advertised for public comment, and it's basically the usual story. They want to be left out. They don't want these duties. Then the Internet Service Providers Association is more detailed, and they submit four things on page 2. That H2 of the bill does not take into account the provisions of Chapter 11 of the Electronic Communications Act. H2.2 can be interpreted as being in conflict with RICA. 8.3 creates an offence. Okay, that's maybe something to look at. But basically, Chair, what I think is that the sections they are objecting to have been in the public domain or were included in the bill as published for public comment. It's unacceptable for anyone to come at the last minute and want to revisit, particularly a bill as old as this bill. What I would suggest we deal with is that we ask Mr. Bassett and his team to respond to the ISPA concerns,
yeah.
But that we do not entertain the issue of. I mean, I've seen what they basically want is they, you know, where the bill says they have a duty, they want to say no, we don't have a duty. They want to be able to carry on as before, and people can use the websites with gay abandon. So I think that the issue is no hearings. That we can, they can make further submissions, written submissions if they want to, because MNET complained they haven't had the opportunity, but Mr. Bassett can, we've got a submission from the ISPA that Mr. Bassett's team can consider it, can give us feedback on it. But that is adequate. But really, this late notice aspect for a bill that has been in the public domain for so long. What version of the bill is this?
That we're now looking at. If you can, more or less, 5th, 6th, 10th.
You've now just gone for data versions, but it's like
approaching nearly 20.
Okay.
You know, MWeb, they want this thing, must take all reasonable steps to prevent the use of its services for the hosting of information referred to in subsections 1C. They want that deleted. They want, you know, that has knowledge that an internet service provider that has knowledge that any internet address contains information, they want it to be actual knowledge. Without delay, take all reasonable steps to prevent access to that internet address by any person. They want that deleted. And then they don't want an offence. I mean, I just think it's unacceptable. But I think the solution is basically that I don't see anything in the MWeb submission. The ISPA can Mr. Bassett's team look at it and make comments as to whether it is in fact not taking into account the E-Communications Act of 2002, whether it is in conflict with RICA of 2002. And so on.
Mr. Swart?
Chair, I'm in broad agreement with that. As to Mr. Bassett looking at the submissions, I haven't had time to look at them carefully. And I think that it would be good if they looked at it and advised us on that. On the issue of hearings, I also agree that we don't need to have hearings, but we can entertain the submissions.
Sure.
But let's just bear in mind that Home Affairs has been on board since the word go. And we are entertaining a lot of submissions. We appreciate that there are serious concerns from Home Affairs. But we are accommodating and looking into what their concerns are. And I think that would be the way to go, to look and see, but we don't have to have oral submissions. Thank you, Chair.
So start saying that spend more time on this bill.
That's the dilemma I'm faced with. You know, we want to finalise it, but it seems that we will now not finalise it now due to valid concerns from Home Affairs. So whilst we've got the time, let us consider the submission that is coming from the internet service providers, Chair. I'm not...
Which is a submission to effectively opt out.
Well, I haven't had the opportunity to read what they're saying. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable members, we are okay with the process set up by Mr. Jeffrey?
Chairperson, yes, I will say, Chairperson, we are in agreement with what Honourable Jeffrey is proposing. I don't think, Chairperson, this can be regarded as closing for any people to be heard. It will be considered whatever they want to bring forward, whatever submission the committee, I think, will have an opportunity to look at.
Okay, fine. All right, Mr. Bassett, you've got a bit of work. Sorry, Mr. Oliver.
Yes, I just wanted it to be clear that when JP talks about people being given opportunity to be heard, doesn't mean that we've been inviting them to make oral submissions to the committee. Just that, JJ said, the department requested to have a look at those submissions and advise us on how to respond, but not to invite more submissions, I mean oral submissions.
Also, so to clarify, we have public hearings, or we have hearings, we have an opportunity for public input. The bill gets advertised, the public get asked to make input in the form of written submissions, and then there are dates set aside for oral submissions. That was done. That is really the closure of the public participation process as required. Because we are wanting to get the best product, we have been entertaining submissions from interested parties, written submissions from interested parties that have particularly related to amendments that the committee is making. My problem with MNET and MWeb and the internet service providers is that they are making submissions on a substantially unamended section of the bill, a section of the bill 8, 2, 3 and 4 that have been there for since the bill was introduced. And I think I just find that unacceptable, and I'm worried that we don't want to open the door to anyone to say, okay, let's look at some other section that we haven't amended.
Yeah.
They want to make submissions on that. So I just think if MNET and MWeb and the Internet Service Providers Association fell asleep, did they come and make submissions, oral submissions?
No.
But if they fell asleep and they woke up 2 years later, that's their problem, and it's particularly one's not particularly sympathetic where they want to escape obligations that the law is trying to impose on them.
Was there a consultation with the internet service providers in terms of the bill as tabled? And if not, why not? Because normally at the back when it says bodies consulted with,
there was anything specific, I'm not too sure during the law commission process but there was an open invitation. After it had gone through the whole law reform commission process, which was a very thorough process and broad consultation, we also published it on our website before we went to cabinet and invited comments, and I think it was also, and I'm speaking under correction, it was a while ago, I think it was also published in the Gazette for comments. I think, yeah.
Let us make it clear, Chairperson, I'm not saying for public hearings.
No.
Yes, I would like to make it very clear.
I understood you that way myself.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Swart.
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, they make some, MWeb makes some Section 8 unjustifiably infringes the constitutional rights to freedom of expression. All right, Mr. Bassett, if you can do that for us. Thank you.
Sorry for belaboring the point, but I'm a little bit incensed by this. 8.2 is an internet service provider operating in the Republic must take all reasonable steps to prevent the use of its service for the hosting of information referred to in 1C, which is basically advertising, publishing, etc., by any means, including the use of the internet, and knows and ought to have reasonably known or suspected that it will be used to facilitate or promote trafficking. So it's basically saying to the internet service providers, take reasonable steps to prevent the use of their services for hosting information, disinformation. What's wrong with that? That has knowledge that any internet address that its server contains information referred to, and it must without delay report that address, take reasonable steps to preserve the evidence and prevent access to that address. So I just think that it's I think the position is pretty and then they don't want it to be an offence.
Chair, can I perhaps just mention that the wording of 8.2 is based on existing legislation, and we have a similar provision in the Films and Publications Act.
Films and Publications?
Yes.
I can just add that this is more or less a similar provision found in the Children's Act, specifically the provisions dealing with the trafficking in children.
I think, as indicated by Mr. Rahman, the provisions in the Freedoms and Publications Act was drafted in consultation with the internet service providers, where I think the major issue was to say they should be able to monitor, you know, the chat rooms and, you know, the services that they provide, and be able to block whatever things they suspect is going towards committing an offence. Thank you.
What I'm just suggesting is, because they've written to you, it's urgent, they need a response, and that the response is maybe not going into the detail, but just expressing the committee's displeasure with late notice on a clause that has not been amended effectively, but that we will look at the issues.
Okay.
There was a concern about it being finalised today as well, which clearly the bill's not going to be finalised.
Well, I'd like to know where they got that from.
Yeah.
But these days everyone says that, so it's become the norm. Alright, we'll respond to them in that fashion. Okay. Anything else, Munani? Nothing?
You see, the bill will be just with the other requirements of the ad hoc committee that's meeting on the... Will we be meeting in January on the bill, do you think, or have you got any idea?
No. Why not? Ad hoc committee first. Okay. That's Mr. Sibanyoni's ad hoc committee will meet first.
Yeah, the bill is largely is basically complete, but for the engagement with Home Affairs, which is important because they are an implementing department. And I think if hopefully that can be completed by the end of January at the latest, it would need to involve other ministers. It would also, because as I said, I think the issue is conflicting interests, Home Affairs interests or concerns around misuse of the Immigration Act generally, and the requirements of the law enforcement agencies particularly. So I think that hopefully by end of January, once that is settled, then the rest of the bill is finished. Unless Mr. Swart and Dr. Ambrosini, who I know has a substantial interest in the internet issue, want to reopen that.
Okay. Honourable members, I have before me the parliamentary programme for next year, the 17th of January till the 27th of January, is set aside for committees and oversight work. I don't know if you have this one. And then they've got the usual members' training, and then again committees from the 7th of February till the 8th of February. That's 2 days. Okay. and the President's State of the Nation address on the 9th. So there you have it. Mr. Sibanyoni, the ad hoc committee, just give us an indication of the program.
No, Chairperson, we will be clear with the program after Monday next week, after the 12th. There is an agent meeting that we will be holding on the 12th of December, and then thereafter we'll come up with a program for January.
The 12th is a meeting of the ad hoc committee or the two chairs?
No, the two chairs.
Two chairs, okay.
The two chairs.
All right, oh, that's a relief, thank you. Okay, well, then that's it, we're done. Unless there's anything urgent from anyone else, it's my pleasant duty to say thank you to you, Mr. Steyn, Mr. Bassett, to you and your team, Mr. Mahok. Thank you for your presence, state law advisors, honorable members, ladies and gentlemen. Have a good Christmas. Try and put your feet up and rest. It's been a very interesting year, and I suspect that next year this committee is going to be unbelievably busy.
Yeah.
We were, but I just get the odd feeling that next year will be even worse. I hope I'm wrong, but let's see. Thank you. We're adjourned.